You are listening to Speak Up Arkansas with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. I'm Rebecca Zimmerman. A recent study by Arkansas Community Institute found that close to 40% of Arkansans have debt that's in collections. These debt burdens can have serious impacts on the well-being of the debt holders and their families. Later in the show, we will be joined by Neil Seeley with Arkansas Community Institute and Bruno Showers with Arkansas Advocates to talk about what debt looks like in Arkansas and potential policy solutions to address the problem. But first, we are joined by Ryder Buttrey with Women's Foundation of Arkansas to discuss the importance of promoting STEM, science, technology, engineering, arts, and math careers for women and girls. Thank you so much for joining us today, Ryder.
Thanks for having me.
So let's get started by talking about what Women's Foundation does.
Yeah, so we've been in this arena for, last year was our 20th year. We'll be having our 21st conference this April. And so we've been doing this work for quite a while. We were some of the first to do it. And we really do it because our mission is women's economic security. And so I'll talk about that a little bit later. But STEM and STEAM careers are higher paying. And so getting girls and women on the track to these career paths does usually lead to economic security, which is our mission. And so we started in 1999 with the conference, the Girls of Promise Conference, which was for eighth grade girls, and it's a 2-day mm-hmm. event. And it's evolved and changed a bit throughout the year. And we now have added, we do 2 coding summits as well that are for 6th through 12th graders, one in the summer and then one in December. So those are really our programs underneath that Girls of Promise initiative that focuses on STEM and STEAM.
Well, I mentioned what STEAM stands for, science, engineering, technology, arts, and math. I got that out of order, but those are what that are in the acronym. So, but can you talk a bit more about what exactly that entails and what you spoke about the Girls of Promise program, but can you go a bit more in depth about that?
Yeah, and so underneath our Girls of Promise initiative, we're also a foundation, so we're a grant maker. So we also actually grant out funds to other organizations that are working in this arena as well, specifically with the gender lens focus. And so a lot of people are familiar with the term STEM, but last year we actually added the A, and that's kind of where some other organizations nationally have moved, is into STEAM, incorporating the arts. And so our first kind of foray into that was a grant to Arkansas Cinema Society to put on a filmmaking lab for teen girls. And so it's really just those science, technology, engineering, arts, and math careers that encompass almost every industry now. There's some facet of tech in them. And so when we added the arts, it was really cool to see the girls, you know, they were doing arts, they were being creative, they were creating these films, but they were also learning sound engineering and lighting and editing, and that there was digital and tech side as well. And so
they're getting all of the acronym.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that was really cool to see. And that's also, you know, film is an industry where women are fairly underrepresented.
And you're listening to Speak Up Arkansas, and we're talking about STEM or STEAM education and girls. If you want to give us a call, if you have a question for our guest, you can call 372. Oh, nope, that's the wrong number. 433-0088. 433-0088. And so, does the Women's Foundation have this focus on STEAM education in particular? Why is that so important to elevate for women and girls?
Yeah, and so I kind of talked about this a bit earlier, but our mission is economic security. And so we see this as a pathway to an economically secure future for girls. The job market is really good. The average pay starting out in these jobs is much higher than other industries. And so that's one portion of it. But it really started about 21 years ago when a group of 100 women founded the Women's Foundation, and several of them were in STEAM careers, and they had noticed an underrepresentation of women and girls in education and also in the workplace. And so they kind of really thought, how can we get girls into these careers? And so that's really where the conference came out of. And now we've been doing it for 21 years, and we've added programs, and we're a larger grant maker. And it's still just become even more important as technology's evolved and the representation hasn't, sadly, reached parity yet. So it's still an issue.
And in some of these STEAM fields, the disparity in the number of men versus women who are serving in those careers is pretty stark. Do you have any of those numbers of the disparity within some of those fields?
I don't have any of them in front of me, but it is quite stark. It's actually, you know, starting out, a lot of our founders were in the medical field, and they have reached parity in medical schools with girls graduating at 50%. But
oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. But they're also, you know, tech, for instance, engineering, in leadership, the numbers of women are still quite small, and so it is still an issue.
Yeah, I saw a article recently that was titled "Where Are All the Women CEOs?"
I read that today. That's actually funny. Yeah, I read that today. It's interesting. We work with a lot of female executives that are in like IT and cyber executive roles, and they're usually, you know, one of the first women in that role, or that they didn't have a female mentor when they were coming up through the ranks.
They were the ones breaking the glass ceiling, even though they've started fairly recently in the field. So Girls of Promise is for eighth grade girls. And I've heard about STEAM over the years, and I've heard also that they're for girls. Seventh grade seems to be a year that you kind of see them start to shift trajectory towards STEAM fields. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, so the research around this is kind of all over the place, just since as the field has become more popular, there's more research done about it now. So back in 99, eighth grade was kind of the year. And I think as more research, the body of research has grown around girls' confidence and things like that, that's usually what is shown is why they quit with an interest in one of these subjects in school, is they don't feel confident, or they don't feel like it's something girls can do. And so it actually, the research is moving younger and younger. And so we've kept our conference at eighth grade, but we also serve 6th through 12th graders through our other programs. And then we also are lucky in that since we're a grant maker, we can really support programs that hit girls at every stage, whether that's postgraduate work, after high school, going on to higher ed or trade schools, or younger girls that trying to keep them from steering off that path and keeping them engaged and motivated.
And what do you attribute to the changing confidence of girls for STEAM fields and thinking that that's not a girl thing to do?
Yeah. So the Girl Scouts actually has some really good research on this that came out, I think, last year. And it really just shows that they actually just get discouraged by parents or teachers or people, peers around them. And it isn't necessarily always explicit, but it's kind of just, you know, they're socialized that that's not what girls are good at. And so that research from Girl Scouts really digs deeper into that kind of phenomenon.
And so people who are discouraging may not even be aware that they're doing it.
Yeah, and it's also representation. I think that lately or recently there's been a larger push. I know Barbie Mattel has done quite a bit around representation as far as having like Barbie astronauts and some of those things. And so girls are seeing themselves in, you know, the toys they're playing with, they're growing up around, versus they haven't really necessarily always had that.
Just the dream car and the dream house, which is still really great, but it's nice to have other options.
Yeah. And so it, you know, sometimes it's not intentional by a parent or a teacher. It's just kind of the society of what girls are surrounded with versus what boys are surrounded with.
And do you have recommendations for parents and teachers to avoid doing that, in ways that they could encourage their female students or their children who are girls to keep their options open in terms of their future?
Yeah, I think I actually think that now with more interest around this, it's becoming easier. I just saw recently Netflix is doing a show on a Hispanic American little girl who is like a scientist. And so I think that the media is catching up, and there, like I said, Mattel has done some things. So there is more opportunity for representation. And so just being kind of intentional that girls are getting the opportunity to see women in these spaces and are encouraged, you know, as they're going through school.
So like buy books that are about female scientists.
Yeah, and we, you know, that's what we try to do through Girls of Promise, is introduce them to women. But the Film Lab, actually, some of their films kind of touched on that. And so I think that making sure they see, whether it's through media or literature or mentors around them, other adults, or even just a girl a couple years older that is pursuing some of these higher level courses.
And where are some resources that they can go to find out more information about STEAM?
Yeah, there's so many resources now, which is great. There's a lot of organizations in the state doing good work around this. STEM Coalition does not focus specifically on girls, but they have a great body of resources. They're kind of the coalition in the state for these STEM education programs. And then Museum of Discovery has a Girls in STEM program that we've granted to multiple times. Mm-hmm. And then there's a ton of national organizations that are doing work here in Arkansas as well. Girls Who Code, I think, has a couple clubs in Arkansas.
Oh, wonderful.
And code.org also has done some really great work around STEM education.
So more and more people are catching on. This is an important thing to report.
Yeah, and Arkansas is we're actually ahead. We were one of the first states to make it a requirement in high schools for them to teach computer science. And I think on code.org, they do like a legislative report card. I think we have an A.
Oh, great.
So, yeah, this is something the governor has championed and the Department of Education has championed, is STEM education for everyone. And so there's more opportunities for girls in schools and boys as well, for everyone.
And I want to talk more about what the Girls of Promise program looks like, the day of, leading up to it, and things like that in just a minute. But you did talk a bit about, you do bring scientists and doctors and things like that who are female to the Girls of Promise program to talk with the girls. And what do you hear from those women that you work with about the barriers they've faced both entering STEAM fields, but also once they're in those fields?
Yeah. So I think for a lot of them coming up, it was first representation, that it wasn't something girls did. They didn't see, you know, their moms, their sisters, women around them in these fields. And then when they got in the workplace, they didn't see any women around the table either. And so that kind of led to a lack of, in some cases, a lack of mentorship. They didn't necessarily have a female mentor. Many of them said they were lucky to have male mentors who helped them. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, it was kind of that only woman at the table or only woman in the room, especially, you know, women of color. And then I also think that there is sometimes, they've spoken about flat out bias, you know, comments like I remember a woman who's very high up in cybersecurity, when she was getting her computer science degree, someone asked her, a male professor asked her, "Why are you in this class?" You know, just straight up. That kind of, they've also experienced that. But I think on a less explicit level, it was just they felt, you know, there wasn't anyone to look to for guidance that necessarily was a female.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like when the same situation a lot of times is when the girls are in seventh or eighth grade. It's the things that you're not really conscious of, but it's building in the back of your brain about accessibility, representation, and what society views you capable of.
Yeah, I think yeah, a lot of it is socialization. And once, if you do get into higher ed or into the workplace, a feeling of isolation. If thankfully now there's more women, but at the time, a lot of them are the only woman in the room.
That this is an aside, but yesterday a article about my coworker Stephanie Malone, written by my coworker Stephanie Malone, who served in the Arkansas General Assembly when she was she started serving, I think when she was 29. She said she sat down at one of the committee tables as a elected official, and someone came to the representative sitting next to her, and he said, representative or whatever, your daughter can't sit at the committee table. And it took her a second to figure out what was happening. They were talking about her, and she was elected official. So
yeah, and I read that article too. Okay. Actually, it was really good. But I think it's kind of those moments, and yeah. So I don't think it's necessarily always barriers that obviously they're largely underrepresented in these industries, so it's a bit more prevalent. But I think a lot of the things they've talked about facing are things that a lot of working women face, whether it's, you know, juggling other responsibilities or pay disparity or just flat out comments like that are inappropriate.
Well, she said they're all fine now. It was just at that moment that wasn't a wonderful thing to hear. But so do you think, from what you've been hearing from the female professionals that you work with, things are maybe changing? Do they see the trajectory of these programs? I mean, all the efforts that's been put in over the years to promote STEM education in girls, do they now see that playing, paying off in the field?
Yeah, and I think, and I hear from girls, since we've been doing it for 21 years, I hear from women now that are in, you know, they're in STEM careers now. And so I do think that representation has been increased, even, like I said, just in the media, but also there's women in these, there's mentors to look to. And so I think that is a big improvement. And like I said, you know, the state took on an initiative to make it more accessible to everyone. I think that in general, with the rise of technology and all of that, it's really become necessary for people to invest in this, and investing in girls who make up more of the workforce is a good investment.
I guess I hadn't thought of that. Like, girls just in their day-to-day lives now use technology so frequently, you can't really stop them from participating in this field because it's become such a central part of their day-to-day lives.
Yeah, and it's you know, it's what the economy is built on now, and so that's another reason that WFA really sees it as a smart investment as far as economic security is involved, because these are, no matter what job they're going into, these are areas they're going to have to be somewhat knowledgeable in.
And when women are paid well, their whole family benefits from that. The whole family does better. So
yeah. And these are also, you know, STEM. There's a lot of trade school STEM fields. And so we like emphasizing, it's not always you have to go to college and get a computer science degree, but you can go to a trade school and be making really great money as a welder and support your family without taking on debt. And so I think that's another cool thing about the field, is there's so many options that it really is ripe with opportunity.
Wherever you want to plug in, you can. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about Girls of Promise, because it's a big deal. It's a whole thing, and there's a lot that goes into it, and there's a lot of opportunities for girls to learn about all these different fields. Can you talk about what that day looks like, how you lead up to the event, and then some other maybe follow-up or other initiatives, like you did talk about with the Cinema Society and other opportunities?
Yeah, so the actual conference, the two-day conference, is our biggest event. We bring 200 girls to Little Rock for 2 days, and it's all of our programs are completely free of charge for the girls. And so we bring girls from across the state. So the months leading up to it is a lot of recruiting. It's mostly done through schools. Teachers come. We have a track for teachers as well. But then it's really just getting girls and especially girls from rural communities or communities where these opportunities may not exist, they may not have access to, they are able to see all the industries that are represented in the state, all the educational opportunities that are available to them, all the career opportunities that are here within the state in mm-hmm. this industry. And then, of course, they're able to not only meet women that are in these industries, but actually meet other girls that are interested in it, too. Because, like I said, that feeling of isolation is often a deterrent for girls to kind of continue if they're interested in something like science and math. And so them getting to meet other girls that have the same interests is a really valuable part of the program.
There are other nerdy artsy girls and it's great.
Yeah, yeah.
So what are some of the activities that they do while they're at Girls of Promise?
Yeah, so everything we make sure is really hands-on. It's not like they're just sitting, you know, learning code all day or anything mm-hmm. like that. But we do a really variety of activities. And so we've had a vet a couple of years come and they bring a dog and they learn to, you know, how to do the exam. We have a black hawk that comes in and they get to learn about all of the mechanics.
Helicopter?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Cool.
They get to learn about all the mechanics of that. It lands down at the 4-H Center and that's a really cool moment. If weather permits, we've had a couple years. But Central Arkansas Water comes and teaches them actually how to do kind of like water testing. We really have a variety of things and we kind of change it up each year. So it's never the same. We like to always feature emerging occupations. So this year, Axiom, who's our presenting sponsor, will be doing a cybersecurity activity with the girls. And so they really get kind of a taste of everything.
And do you have a alumni group for the girls?
So we do not. We okay. have alumni that are engaged. I have a committee that helps me plan the conference, and I have some alumni on that. And then just in general, I have alumni kind of reach out and ask how I can, you know, how can I get involved or I'd like to volunteer. And so we have alumni engaged, but it's not a formalized group.
And you do research to like make sure that this program's working and that the girls are really learning and getting excited about STEAM fields, right? Can you talk about that and the results that you've seen from this program over the years?
Yeah, so we're actually in the midst. It's kind of the program's changed a bit throughout the years. It used to be across the state on different college campuses, so it was more regional. And then it was moved and centralized to Little Rock. And so the data isn't super linear, but actually in our 2020 plan, that is something that we are hoping to do is to produce an impact assessment of the program. And we've been awarded a VISTA program. And so one of our VISTAs will be helping with data collection and producing that. So we're really excited about that.
Okay, cool. That's great. So what are some of the other opportunities that you have funded? You've mentioned a couple, but it sounds like you want to make sure that throughout the year, throughout the state, that girls have these opportunities.
Yeah. So I'm trying to kind of think of on different ends of the age spectrum. You know, we have funded Museum of Discovery for a couple of years. And then we actually gave our largest grant, which was back in 2018, our largest one grant to one organization to East Initiative, which is a computer STEM program in schools. And so they were able to really go across the state. They have a large footprint across the state. And so mm-hmm. we were able to get into some communities where as a small organization, we don't necessarily always reach. And that was a great partnership. They have amazing students that come out of that program and they have complete parity in that program with girls, which is amazing. But we also in the past year granted to UA Little Rock for the Ray Montague Scholarship. So for a girl that is going into a field at UA Little Rock. So that's mm-hmm. kind of the older end of the spectrum. And then the film lab is for 11th and 12th graders. So a little bit older as well.
And do you find, I mean, people apply for your grants for these programs, but do you think there are many opportunities available for funding for programs like that in Arkansas, or is it a bit of struggle for people to find that?
Honestly, I think, you know, we're lucky in that we were one of the first people doing this work, and so we have that longer body of work to say we've been invested in this for a while, but there's so many people doing this work now, and mm-hmm. so companies have really realized, you know, the importance of if we want our workforce to develop and we want to be able to have the workers we need, we have to invest in this. And so corporate sponsorships are, you know, a huge help. Axiom's been our presenting sponsor for 2 years because they understand, you know, what this means for them as well, for their workforce. Mm-hmm. And then I think also, you know, there's national attention on this. And so there are funding opportunities nationally because people really are invested in this work.
Well, hopefully with all this investment and all this focus on STEAM, that we'll see the same change in parity that we've seen in the medical field and these other fields too.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's just, there's so many industries and areas that STEAM touches, and so it's exposing girls to as many of those as we can. And yeah, seeing what we've seen with medical school enrollment across the board.
And if people want to learn more about the Women's Foundation of Arkansas, how can they do that?
They can go to www.womensfoundationarkansas.org. But then if they want to learn specifically more about Girls of Promise, we also have girlsofpromise.org, which is just for our Girls of Promise initiative.
Well, Ryder, thank you so much for being on the show. We really appreciate it and the work that you do at Women's Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us. We're going to take a quick 3-minute break and we'll be back talking about debt in Arkansas.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Juan Parra grew up in Union City, New Jersey, a working-class, predominantly Latino community. When he was young, he associated environmentalism with faraway problems, like polar bears stranded on ice.
And I never really thought about how it applied to communities that were similar to where I grew up.
But in college, Parra started learning how environmental issues affect low-income communities of color. For example, they often bear the brunt of pollution caused by the burning of fossil fuels. Today, he works for a New York City-based nonprofit called Solar One, helping to implement community solar projects in low-income areas. By subscribing, people can get their electricity from a shared solar project without an upfront investment.
We want to encourage the development and the expansion of community solar because it's a way for so many people to gain access to solar energy, particularly renters, particularly low and moderate income households.
He says expanding access to solar is important, not only for improving air quality, health, and the climate, but because it can save people money. He wants to make sure that as renewable energy grows, its benefits reach the communities, like his hometown, that may need them the most. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
You are listening to Speak Up Arkansas with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. I'm Rebecca Zimmerman, and I lied just a minute ago because I got our next guest in quicker than I thought I would. So we just took a minute and 30 second break, but we're back with Neil Seeley with Arkansas Community Institute and Bruno Showers with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families to talk about debt in Arkansas. So thank you both so much for joining us today. And Neil, Arkansas Community Institute just released a report this year, I think, on debt in Arkansas, and you've been doing that research for a while before you released the report. Can you talk about why you even decided to do a report focused on debt?
Sure. So we have two organizations. We're downstairs from KBF. And one is the Arkansas Community Institute, a C3, and Arkansas Community Organizations, which is a 501c4. So we have done over the years a lot of work on financial issues. So as people know, we grew out of the old Acorn. And so we have had housing counseling and credit counseling programs here for years. And so we know a lot about people's financial issues, debt, and we also know that there are institutions that help, that create debt and kind of trap people in debt. So over the years, we've dealt with the hot check court in Sherwood, which is very predatory, and you know, it's against the law to bounce a check in Arkansas, and there it's the court charges very, very high fines and fees. Mm-hmm. And before a lawsuit did put people in jail, and that some of those abuses have been curbed, but they're still there, and other courts do that as well. We've done a lot in the area of medical debt and getting people access to health care. And so a particular concern of ours is what happens to people when they go to the hospital and the kind of bills they get. And student loan, a lot of our members are carrying tens of thousands of dollars in student loan debt. And we'll hopefully be able to talk about that a little bit later. So those are all issues that we knew about. And the issue of debt and financial issues touches on so many other issues, criminal justice reform, access to health care, and access to a good education. So all of those. So it's a different lens to view all of those issues.
And we talked at the top of our show, we mentioned that right off the bat in the report, you mentioned that nearly 40% of our Kansans have debt that's in collections. So this obviously is a really big problem to research. So how did you go about researching this?
Well, so luckily we had, we're part of a group called the Southern Partnership to Reduce Debt, which has organizations in seven states, as well as a lot of national partners. And one of those national partners is the Urban Institute. So a lot of the data that we used in our report came from the Urban Institute. It has a really neat tool called the Interactive Debt Map, basically. Mm-hmm. And they have looked at student loan debt, auto loans, and medical debt, and then debt in collections. And so it does a very good job of showing the disparities that exist between Black and Latinx communities and the white community in how debt impacts them, and people.
Can I jump in just for a second on that one, Neil? Because I checked out that Urban Institute Debt Collection Interactive, and it was great, but I did notice something about it that I think is worth pointing out. I think it actually understates the disparity between communities of color and white communities, specifically because it only looks at consumer debt, which, from what I understand, doesn't include like court criminal justice debt, which is sort of a separate thing. So, so I just wanted to point that out. Is that
looking at consumer debt,
right?
So it's not looking at the court fines and fees. So there are other studies, not as comprehensive, but there was a study, a good one, and I'll get you all the reference, but it's of some communities in Missouri where there's a tremendous disparity between what happens with criminal justice debt in Black and white families. And so in our report, we felt that the case had been made, that there were these disparities. So we wanted to see how they actually, we wanted to hear from the people themselves impacted by that.
And so you, in addition to the data, you went out and actually interviewed people who were facing these different types of debt.
Yeah. So what we did, the first thing we did was to we do free tax filing in Little Rock and Pine Bluff. Most of our, the average income of people who use our tax sites is around $20,000. And it is overwhelmingly Black and overwhelmingly women. And so we felt it was a good place to start to move these surveys. So we got about 1,000 surveys through our TAC site.
Oh, wow.
And then we went out in the community and got another 800 or so. So we ended up with a little over 1,800 surveys. And then we also have done a second survey in 2019 that we're just have finished databasing. We're using it primarily, and we asked more specific questions about the kinds of debt that we found people were talking about on the first survey. And we then circled back with people who said they were willing to gave their information, contact information to us. And so we did about 20 interviews with those people.
And you're listening to Speak Up Arkansas, and we are talking about debt in Arkansas. If you have any questions for our guests, you can give us a call at 433-0088. And Neil, and Bruno, if you could both talk about, you mentioned several major types of debt that you saw. Can you go more into depth about those different types of debt and what those look like and how are those caused?
Okay. So we found that the types of debt that were held, the most student loan was the highest, followed very closely by medical debt. Then there was a concern about auto loans, and we are just now kind of, we know what's going on, but we're just now hearing from people sort of what exactly is happening. So that's an area. And the fourth, which I thought the percentage was actually astonishingly high, were people who had some kind of justice system debt. So in the interviews, we learned more about what caused those things. So those would be the top four that we discovered through our survey.
And I agree that I thought the criminal justice debt was really high. The thing that sticks out to me actually is because, you know, and I don't mean this as a criticism, Neil, but as you guys say in the report, it's not a random sample, you know.
Right.
It's a self-selected group. So I kind of my intuition would tell me that might even be higher among the general population,
people not coming in to
right.
do their taxes
exactly.
or not employed. And yeah,
exactly.
I think that's right. And then I was also astonished at the number of people who reported having their driver's licenses suspended, which I think may even be higher too.
Yeah.
But it's, 10% was roughly. So, my gosh, that's a lot of people.
Yeah.
Not being able, well, they just, many of them still drive, but yep. because they have to in order to get to work.
And can you talk a bit about how, that sounded weird, talk a bit about how the people that you interviewed fell into these debt situations, either through student loans or through auto loans, criminal justice loans? What were some common themes that you heard? And was there anything that was particularly shocking? I mean, it sounds like a lot of these situations are pretty devastating in people's overall well-being.
Yeah, so about half of the people reported having multiple debt. And a little under half did. And so what we find is that, a good example is a medical bill. So a good example is a woman who had a dental bill dating from the 90s, I think.
Oh, wow.
And it was for $59. And she just forgot about it for a long time. It was thought nothing was happening. And then all of a sudden it appears in the Sherwood court, and it has ballooned into a couple of thousand dollars. And so here we had probably a debt she could have paid off very easily back if she had not, if she knew about it, or I don't think she really even knew about that $59 debt. Now ballooning into a higher debt because of failure to appear and all the sort of stuff that's tacked on to it. So that's sort of where the two, one kind of debt caused another kind of debt.
And I would like to speak a little bit to the criminal justice debt portion of that and how that came about. And sort of, you know, Neil has the opportunity to be out in the community a lot more than me and do this kind of story gathering and stuff. But the way that I think about these things is more in terms of state and local government budgets and how these sort of things interact with fines and fees and taxes. And so in Arkansas, we in 1995, in order to kind of create uniform court costs and fees, because different localities were setting their own fees and court costs, and some of these weren't justified. So I think there actually was a good logic behind it at the time. It created this system called the Arkansas, or the Administration of Justice Fund, where basically everyone across the state pays the same court fees and costs. They all go to a central location, and then those get kind of doled back out to localities based on a couple different criteria. The problem with that is that we found it wasn't really a sufficient source of revenue to fund all the different administrative functions of the courts that we were asking it to fund. To give you just a brief list, a not comprehensive list of things that the Administration of Justice Fund actually funds at the state level. Some of it goes to the Department of Health, some goes to state police, some goes to the Attorney General's office, some goes to the Office of the Prosecuting Coordinator, the Code Revision Commission, the Criminal Information System, the Public Defender's Commission. Some of it goes to UALR and U of A for some reason. Some of it goes to the crime lab. So there's just a lot of different agencies that are getting money, and the level that we set it at in 1995 wasn't enough to cover all those costs. So we just kept adding more ways for municipalities in the state to increase fines. So I went through Pulaski County. In addition to this Administration of Justice funding, they also get municipal court fines is a source of revenue for them. Mm-hmm. There's municipal court costs and the probation fund. On top of that, there's warrant fees and payment fees. So if they find that you have no ability to pay and you need to go on a payment plan, they can charge you $5 a month to because you can't pay. And then there's actually another $5 charge on top of that that goes to fund a different kind of court. One of the $5 goes to the district court. One of the $5 goes to circuit courts. The Public Defender's Commission, in addition to that central thing, they have user fees, they have bail bond fees, and they have attorney fees. And this is just stuff that I've looked up in the last couple of days. So yeah. I'm sure there's a ton more. Yeah. But so I just wanted to kind of, you know, I think there's a bad incentive there because I think a lot of people in power view these fines and fees as a way to kind of pay for very necessary government functions without raising taxes. But the reality is that it's just not sustainable for some of the reasons that Neil's talking about.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right on the money there.
And
no pun intended. But yeah, like half, I believe, last I looked, and I think half of the budget for the district courts in Little Rock are from fines and fees.
That sounds about right to me.
Yeah,
I don't know
50%.
Off the top of the head. Yeah,
so. And then you've got these little towns that are notorious for, like Grady. No offense, folks in Grady, but if you're going through Grady, go as slow as you can. Because, they will stop you. And then along I-40, Faulkner, it's just all of these. And that's right. It's because there's no uniform taxpayer-funded. These courts are not funded.
Exactly.
But I think other communities across the country have found that if you can also reduce the cost of the court by asking the ability to pay and basing fines on that, there's less administrative, because you have to go fine. I mean, Sherwood had a whole crew, still has, of people going out delivering warrants to people, and when they used to bring them into jail, they would all that. So that costs a lot of money.
The problem with, from my perspective, is like the budget guy, the issue we have is that there's not good accounting behind all these, or right. between, because like I just mentioned, there's, you know, there's county governments, city governments, state governments, other yeah. just like district courts, different levels of government involved, and they all share some of the fines and fees and some of the tax base, but it's not, there's no like central portal. I can't go to the state government yeah. website and be like, this is how much Valonius spends trying to collect debt and this is how much they get out of the debt. You can kind of go into like BLR and the legislative audit and find some of that info, but it's just difficult to do. Yeah, I would say.
So, Bruno, you mentioned like a million different fees that people have to pay. I mean, it sounds really complicated. Neil, is it clear to people who are being asked to pay these fees what all these fees are and that they're being asked to pay all of them?
Probably not for most people. I think they find out eventually as they read, you know, what they're being charged for. But yeah, I think most people don't. Many people don't even realize they're in trouble. Like, say, for if I will pick on sure, we'll continue for a bounced check, they may not even know it until the warrant shows up. And some people may not even know their driver's license is suspended until they're stopped and they're on the list. So, and we have a very disconnected judicial system. So if you get that ticket in Grady, you have to drive down to Grady to deal. Or you can either send in the payment, or if you want to contest it, you have to drive down to Grady and go to the court. Or if you've had tickets in multiple cities, there's no one place to pay if you want to make good. Okay, yeah, I did mess up, and I admit I'm guilty. You have to go pay it to all those different places. With there could be one place that you could pay that. Or let's say if you don't have transportation to go to Grady, you should be able to go to a court here and have that trial or make your case.
And what did education debt look like with the people you talked to?
It's horrible. It really is. It's so one woman, one story we in our study talks about a woman who wanted to refinance her house, but she couldn't because her debt to income ratio was not, and she wanted to buy, refinance that, turn it into a rent house and go buy a new house. But she couldn't do that because of the more than $100,000 of student loan debt that she had. And her debt to income ratio basically disqualified her for a loan. So it prevents people from getting ahead. There are a growing number of seniors who owe student loan debts, so more than 2 million nationally. And it's, yeah, people are basically, and the one bad thing is the interest just keeps growing. So we're building cohorts of people who, one of our goals after the study is to build groups of people impacted by the debt. So in one of our meetings, woman talked about she left UALR with $30,000 in debt. It is now $54,000. I've never, because I'm old, right? So it wasn't like as bad back then. But for many
it's
of you all
close
who
to
are
home
young,
for Bruno and I,
yeah,
yeah, right. I was gonna hope you all might say something about that.
Let me. I'll just say that $30,000 sounds low to me based yeah. on my debt, but that's you know, that's a indication of like the problem there, right? You know,
yeah, yeah. Our credit counselor, who I'd hope could be here, has around $100,000 in debt. And then we see the case where parents have to co-sign if someone is, you know, not, I forget what the, I guess, not 18 yet, they have to co-sign. So that debt you will go to them probably.
And then they have loans just for parents too, for student loans.
Oh, really?
Yep. They're called Parent Plus loans.
Oh. Wow.
Yep. Loans on loans, right?
God.
Stacking debt on top of debt.
Yeah.
So you talked briefly about this at the beginning of the segment, but there are clear racial inequities around debt. And we see in the work of Arkansas Advocates, racial inequities across the board and basically everything we work on. But are there specific policies that you see causing these disparities, and what are some solutions that you have identified in your report that could address it?
Well, I think definitely the court fines and fees issue does fall much more heavily on Black communities in Arkansas. And if you go down to any district court in Pulaski County, and you'll see that difference. And that even applies to environmental court as well. Who I think the judge wants to do the right thing and be fair, but so many of the people that get dinged by code are low-income people who can't fix the property or in some violation. And that's where code enforcement does most of its work. And so we find that a very interesting contrast to housing code work, where an apartment complex can go 3 months without providing natural gas to people, even though that's part of their lease, and get away with it, basically. There are those disparities. I think medical debt, you know, the uninsured rate is highest amongst Black and Latinx people than white people. And the income disparities, I think, are really what make debt so much more devastating, because there are, and it's just so well documented, very, very clear in income disparities between women and men, and between groups of people, Black and Latinx and white. And so a debt that maybe a white family could cope and handle with becomes much more devastating to a Black household. And I think often student loans I think everybody leaves with debt, but I think that's especially a problem for Black families. And the problem is that we borrowed all this money, so we expect a better job, but that doesn't necessarily happen.
Yeah, and I think I was going to say that. I'm glad you mentioned that, Neil. I think a great demonstration of that is based on both the Urban Institute and I think what you guys found is that Black families were more likely to have even student loan debt than white families, but yet their average income was like two-thirds or less than what white families are. And I think I've seen projections that Black net worth is going down, as opposed to, like, you know, it's a quote unquote good economy and a lot of people are doing well, but for Black families it's getting worse because they invest a lot in education and then they don't get the returns that we do as white people.
Yeah, and in our just interaction with people who have student loan debt, that's the common theme: why this wasn't worth it. Yeah. It hasn't made my life better.
And basically what you're saying is what Bruno often talks about, that these things are all interconnected, and this is a perfect example of why we have generational poverty. Can you talk about that, Bruno?
Well, I think Neil actually did a great job, I mean, honestly, of setting up what the poverty trap looks like. You know, like you're speeding so that you can make it to work through some random right. little town, and then you lose your driver's license, and so you get arrested because you're driving fast through this little town trying to get work because you need to get to work to feed your family, and now you're... You know, now your family is down one income, and how does that help anybody? I know if you have kids, they're certainly not better off because you got jailed because you couldn't pay debt you didn't know you had. I, you know, not to kind of take the target off my back here, but I can't add really much to what Neil said. I think that was good. A policy solution that I feel obligated to plug that, you know, but not a silver bullet, but the earned income tax credit, research has shown that about 70% of families or people that receive the EITC, like they use that to pay down debt immediately, either actual consumer debt that's in collections or they're behind on bills and they pay it back up, you know? So I think that is, you know, it's not going to fix medical debt or student loan debt or anything, but it's one way to kind of address the problems with our tax system that lead to these disparities.
Yeah, it would be a huge help to families and just often the refund is so small from the state, or people can get a big refund from the feds and have to pay in the state. Yeah. So it would provide some relief for sure.
And we just have about 2 minutes left, and we've talked a lot about this issue policy-wise, but also personal stories. But there may be listeners on the show right now who are in this situation. Are there resources that they can connect with to help them through this situation?
We do have a loan counselor on our staff, or a housing counselor and a credit counselor. So we're focusing much less if people want to become homeowners, great, but she's very good at helping people navigate student loans. And so we're sort of turning it into more of a direct credit counseling. Mm-hmm. And then I fully recommend Credit Counseling of Arkansas out of Fayetteville. They're very, very good and very committed.
And where can people go find information? Like, what's your phone number and what's the address?
Yeah, 501-376-7151 is our number. And my extension is 1. And you can also send us a message through our website at arkansascomm.org.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us today to talk about what is a huge problem for many Arkansans. 40% have debt in collections, but even more probably have debt that's pretty overwhelming. Yeah. And so look forward to hearing about the research that you're wrapping up right now and what you found in that. So thank you both so much for joining us. And this is Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families' last show on Speak Up Arkansas. We've enjoyed talking with you over the past 3 years about a wide range of issues impacting kids and families in this state. So thank you all so much for listening over the past few years.
This is KABF in Little Rock, 88.3, the voice of the people in Central Arkansas.
This is Wade Brathke with the Chief Organizer's Report. Faking the voters.